to everyone, and thank you to everyone at Creighton University for hosting us here today. With that, we will begin arguments. Our first case of the day is State versus Henry O. Salvador Rodriguez. Mr. Penn, good morning to you. You may approach.
Good morning.
You may proceed.
Yes, may it please the court, opposing counsel, ladies and gentlemen of the audience. We have four assignments of error, and I will first address the first assignment, which is that the district court erred in overruling our motion to suppress the search of a house due to lack of a warrant based on consent. And I think the legal phrase that is commonly used in analyzing the circumstances always the warrant requirement, not here are the what's reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, here is what's required in this situation under the Fourth Amendment with narrowly tailored exceptions. And what they mean is it's exception to the word requirement. So it has to be a really good exception is what I think it means. And when people have fit into one of those exceptions, I think they have done so by articulating very well why they are fitting into one of those exceptions. And I don't think it had to be forced. I don't think later they had to sort of work back through the logic and say, well, even though they didn't necessarily be able to articulate why they were fitting into an exception, maybe we can articulate for them why they are fitting into an exception.
What were the facts surrounding the search of this premises?
Well, you know, a lot of different versions of the facts were given at the various hearings, but eventually it was concluded, well, in an order of, after the first hearing on this suppression motion, that the girl who consented, Lori Azell, had been staying at this residence at 708 North Spruce Street, the searched house, on and off to escape her domestic partner. She was
reported what she thought was a burglary, didn't she?
Well, I think she reported, she said...
she left the house with her children to go get an ice cream cone, locked the door, had the lights turned off. When she came back, the door was ajar, the lights were on, and subsequently, all the doors in her van were open, including the back tailgate. Now, is that an exigent circumstance that would justify the police entering and looking for a potential burglar in the premises?
Well, I would argue it wouldn't be, because I think there was a lot to think that it wasn't a burglary, and I don't think she ever told police that she necessarily thought it was, that she just was paranoid as well as high.
Well, she thought she saw a person in the garage. Her son said he saw a person in the garage, and she asked the police, could you check for a burglar in the premises? And isn't that an undisputed statement of the facts?
Well, she gave various versions of the facts at the various hearings.
What did the trial judge determine that the facts were?
His findings of facts at the ruling, and I have his order right here, stated, Azell advised that her friends, Rosa Anguina and Henry Salvador, were out of town, and Azell had been house-sitting in their absence. I don't think she actually used that phrase, which was brought up at the second hearing. But anyway, it also goes on to say she had a key to the premises, stayed there off and on. Her and Chavez were fighting, and even had a room of her own at the premises. Then going down, because I guess that's not addressing exactly what you asked. After a couple hours, Azell called Officer Wackler and reported that she and her child were gone for a walk. When she returned to 708 Spruce, the lights inside the residence were on, and she thought she saw someone in the garage. And that's the conclusions of facts.
And there's nothing about that that's clearly wrong, is there?
I suppose nothing is wrong. I think the disputed is that the that you would deduce that what she felt was a burglar, because there was one person that was not expected to be in that house that evening. That was Lori Zell. She had been staying at her boyfriend's house, and she went over there after being kicked out.
What is our standard of review with respect to findings of fact on a ruling on a motion to suppress?
clearly erroneous, although I think that standard, has been changed to some extent, just not very clearly, by the recent case law, which when the Supreme Court of the United States or even this court analyzes things, it seems to go through the record and look at what was testified and apply those facts to what it is then terming the law in terms of whether it would justify the search or lack thereof.
What would be our standard of review with respect to legal conclusions of the trial court on a ruling to motion to suppress?
Well, that would be a legal question to be reviewed de novo.
Okay. So that's the difference.
Right, and I think it has become fuzzy, the cross between those.
Do you have a citation for the case that makes this fuzzy?
Well, I would say a State versus Everly, that has to do with exigent circumstances. That's not quite as funny, but fuzzy, but it states that it's rejecting the total clearly erroneous standard in terms, and instead adopting a standard the Eighth Circuit had put forth, that you, I believe the term the court used, and I think to print that case on, was essentially looking at sort of the I suppose.
Well, let me interrupt your train of thought here. Why wouldn't a reasonable police officer, based upon the facts that were relayed to him, believe that there might be a burglary in process and that a search of the premises was necessary for the protection of the individual that was residing there?
Well,
isn't this a situation where there's an exigent circumstance? Not so much her consent, but the fact that she is staying there by permission of the owner or the person who leases the premises, and she suspects that there's been a burglar in her premises.
Well, I think it's not reasonable.
What would a reasonable police officer do under those circumstances? Say, well, sorry, we can't go in and search for people. We have to go get a warrant?
Before they searched, they had Lori Zell bring the key back to them. They had another police officer come and show up, and I think during all that time period, they very simply could have called the other residents of the house. There was plenty of time.
Well, that wouldn't have anything to do with finding out whether there was a burglar in the house. When they were asked to search, or they went in to search, they searched only where a person could hide. They didn't look inside the oven. You know, they didn't look in the cupboard. They looked in closets and rooms for a person who might be hiding in that premises.
Your Honor, I don't think that a reasonable police officer would have believed that a burglary was taking place in the circumstance that the only person...
What would you think would be unreasonable about believing that when you left the premises, with the lights off and the door locked, and you come back, the lights are on, the door is ajar, and the doors to your car are open, and the back hatchback is open, and none of that existed when you left?
Well, because you're the intruder in the house. She was the one that was unexpected to be there that evening, and there were people that did live there, and maybe they were curious why
didn't
someone...
Didn't she know they were gone, and didn't she know that she was house-sitting and taking care of their dog? Didn't she have a key?
Well, she knew that they were gone. There's no evidence that she didn't expect them back immediately, and I think there was plenty of reason to believe. And as they did call the people later, it was very easy to get a hold of them, and they found out, well, sure, they were having someone check on the house. and that's...
Is it significant to our analysis that the police, that Ms. Ezell called the police, summoned them to the home, said she was frightened, explained why she was frightened, and asked the police to check the house?
I don't necessarily think that, certainly I think that process gave the police reason to conduct further inquiry. I don't think it gave them an emergency to barge in without stating, hey, what else could be going on here?
Why wasn't the continuing possession of the methamphetamine, why is that 404 evidence that should have been given a limiting instruction?
Well, Your Honor, I think when it was very first put forward, and I think a lot of people sort of dropped the ball on this, that there may have been, it may have fallen into an exception or necessary for foundation, but then it was returned and dwelled upon a lot by the prosecution. And to the extent that they compared him in their closing arguments exactly how it happened in the past with how it happened in or around, and how it was found in or around the date and the information.
Wasn't he charged with intent to distribute methamphetamine?
Yes.
So the fact that he used it with other people previously and had it in his possession and made it available, would that have been intertwined with the charge?
I would say you're defining conformity. I would say the fact that he used it as evidence.
And he shared it with other people in his home and took it from under the couch.
Right.
Is that intertwined with the delivery?
Well, I think you could... I think that's saying he acted very similarly then, so he probably acted very similarly on the date and the on the information, so we are more or less defining conformity. And I think, you know, regardless, a limiting instruction was requested, it wasn't granted. Also,
does it need to be if it's intertwined?
Well, it says in 404 that the state really needs to state, the court needs to state, why are we admitting this evidence? Whether they state it on the record, and actually I think the law is clear that if a limiting instruction is requested, it has to be granted. But the court made no statement.
If it's requested, it has to be granted?
I believe that was in their State versus Payne McCoy made some legal that.
Well, an instruction may be required if it is 404 evidence, but if it's not 404 evidence and is merely evidence that's intrinsic to the crime, you're not necessarily entitled to that instruction, are you?
Well, I think it's other bad acts. Whether it falls into exception, whether it's allowable, it's another question on whether it's other bad acts. It's clearly another bad act, right?
Was a 404 hearing ever requested?
No. My understanding, reading just the plain language of the statute, is it puts the burden on the prosecution to prove it outside the presence of the jury and not on the defense to request that proof beforehand. But
wasn't it the prosecutor's position that that evidence was inextricably intertwined?
Unfortunately, the argument put to the court was in a sidebar of the record, and the phrase that she continually used was independent relevance and requires foundation. And, I think there was a point, as I said, at the very beginning, where maybe to establish the relationship between defendant Salvador and Lori Ezell, that it could have been limited to a certain extent admissible, but I think overall it was brought up and used to an extent that went way beyond that. And most importantly, I think they never stated why it was inextricably intertwined. They just said it's inextricably intertwined, but they never really stated, well, here's why we think it's inextricably intertwined. They said, okay, here's our exception to 404. Can we follow it, please? And I don't think they ever really made a good argument that it was independently relevant or that it ever was inextricably intertwined with the date of the information and the charges, other than saying that it was so similar that we'd really like to admit it, which is basically saying it's conformity.
Mr. Penn, I think we've asked you a lot of questions, and we've gone well over the 10-minute allotted time at this point in time, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Duffy, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Appellant's claims on appeal can be broken down into three areas. His claims related to the denial of his motion to suppress, the admission of evidence at trial regarding his past drug use and the failure to give a limiting instruction on the same, and the overruling of objections to comments made by the state during closing arguments. The state believes the district court correctly ruled on all these issues, and we ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court. Regarding
why isn't the prior possession 404 evidence?
Your Honor, it was, the state believes it was inextricably intertwined with the crime that was charged. It was asked about how they knew each other, and then it was narrowly tailored after a certain point to focus on the time period at issue, the summer of 2014. And
information charge a crime during a particular time frame or on a particular date?
It was on a particular date, Your Honor. But I think that based on the relationship between Ezell and the appellant, that it was an ongoing relationship.
Well, the evidence initially was that she was testifying that she was smoking methamphetamine with the defendant on prior occasions, and that came from underneath the couch.
Correct, Your Honor.
So it wasn't until the prosecution asked whether there were other people present at different periods of time that the objection was made. So wasn't there evidence already in the record that he possessed this and was getting it from underneath the couch and they were smoking?
Your Honor, there was. I believe...
But the question then becomes, that might just be a social use and he's not distributing. So when other people come and don't bring their methamphetamine and then are smoking it, isn't that part of the crime that's involved?
That's correct, Your Honor. And that
where,
is...
Where were the drugs found?
There were... There were drugs found under the couch, and then there were also drugs located under a sink, I believe maybe in a pipe. I don't believe when you opened the cabinet under the sink that they were readily viewable. So there were drugs located under the couch, which is where the witness testified that appellant would retrieve the methamphetamine when it was smoked together.
There was a large amount underneath the kitchen sink.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it was around 300 grams. The amount under the couch was a smaller amount, I think around 17.
And still, if you possess more than 10 grams, then you are presumed to be in possession with intent to distribute?
Your Honor, I'm not positive. I apologize on whether it's a per se rule, but the jury was instructed to find either that he possessed 10 or more or less than 10.
Where did that instruction come from? How did this 10... number 10 developed in this case?
That was the charge, Your Honor. I'm not positive on why the number was set at the 10.
Was there testimony that larger amounts suggest distribution?
Yes, Your Honor. One of the police officers who testified did testify that based on his law enforcement experience that he believed that the amounts that appellant that were found in appellant's home were not consistent with personal use.
Is that cutoff statutory?
Your Honor, I do not recall. I apologize. Don't have the statute in front of me. It may be. I believe that it does change it from certain classes of felonies based on the... Actually, it may not based on the amount. I apologize. I'm unsure.
But there's a distinction between what class it is and what crime it is.
I think that the larger amount... Your Honor, I'm unsure. I don't want to give you an incorrect answer. I'm sorry.
Let me ask you about your comments about 404. How do the facts in this case square with our case law in regard to inextricably intertwined?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that this court has stated that when the evidence is inextricably intertwined with the facts of the crime charge, that it helps the prosecution present a complete picture of the crime at issue, that the evidence is not Rule 404. And so, thus, a limiting instruction would not be required, that it would not be evidence of prior bad acts, but instead it is part of the...
Would you say this court has taken an expansive expansive view of inextricably intertwined or a very narrow view?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's a little fact-intensive. The case that comes to mind is Smith, State v. Smith in 2013, and I think this court held that some of the evidence of the interactions between the parties previously maybe things that the appellant in that case had possessed were a part of, it helped form a complete picture of the crime charge.
How would drug use 2 or 3 months before the date alleged in the information be inextricably intertwined with this crime?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it sets up the relationship between the parties, and then when the evidence came in that other people would come over, that those other people did not bring drugs with them to the home, that it was all supplied by appellant, and that it was pulled out from under the couch where drugs were found during the searches. I mean, those are all a part of the crime charge.
So I understand the logic of that answer. It's that because it happened on a previous occasion, it's more likely that it happened on the charged occasion. Isn't that the logic of the answer you just gave us?
Maybe to an extent, but I also think that it...
Isn't that classic propensity reasoning?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it could be, but I think that that evidence also is painting this picture of the crime that was charged. And I realize that to an extent when these acts come in, that there is an argument that can be made that they are prior bad acts. But I think the prosecution was clear. I don't know what was said in the sidebar, but during the jury instruction conference, the prosecution did argue and make clear that they were using this to show it was the facts of the crime charge.
I want to ask you about the discussion about requested instruction. Even if it's not 404 evidence, and even if it is inextricably intertwined, isn't there a possibility that an instruction to the jury may be appropriate?
Well, Your Honor, I haven't fully thought that out, but I think that even if this court were to determine that an instruction should have been given, that is not the end of the inquiry.
Was the instruction that was requested an accurate statement of the law?
There were two instructions proposed, Your Honor, and I haven't fully analyzed them. I think even assuming that they were, I don't think that the appellant can show prejudice from a failure to give those instructions, because Izell also testified that when appellant heard the police were searching his home, he specifically told her, "I am involved in selling or dealing methamphetamine." And I think that that statement, was very clear.
How did that statement come into evidence, and was there an objection to it?
Your Honor, I don't recall if there was an objection. It came out at trial. Izell testified that when she was with appellant, she was with him. They were out of town at the time that he found out that the police were searching his home. So the police searched the home in the initial search the night when appellant was out of town. And I believe about a week later, police had obtained a search warrant and then went back to the home. Izell was with appellant at that time, and she testified that when he heard police were at his home, he told her that he was involved in selling methamphetamine.
The instruction that was requested, was that only requested as an instruction within the course of the evidence, or was it requested at the time of the final instruction conference?
Your Honor, I believe it was only requested during the jury instruction conference, so after.
So, to be included in the final instruction?
Correct, Your Honor, correct.
And what was the trial court's reasoning in not giving the instruction?
The trial court determined that the evidence was not Rule 404. It was not evidence of prior bad acts under Rule 404, that it was inextricably intertwined with the crime charge. And because it was not 404, a limiting instruction was not required.
So both versions of the request were tied to 404?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe so. I can't recall verbatim that portion of the record, but I do believe.
What would be an element of the crime charge? Possession with intent to distribute. Would the evidence that he had this methamphetamine on prior occasions be 404 evidence, extrinsic evidence, or would it be intrinsic to the crime charge? Because at some point in time, she has to establish that he's had this and that other people have used it also, at that time, and they came to the place without anything, and that he furnished that to them. Isn't that the elements of the crime charge?
Yes, Your Honor. So it is, the state's position is that this was a part of the crime charge that formed the factual setting, and so it was not evidence of prior bad acts.
Yes, he's had it before. He still has it. It's continuing. He has it all the time. And sometimes then other people come and use it who aren't necessarily his smoking buddy, so that he's distributing it to other people who come there without methamphetamine.
Yes, Your Honor.
Should this have been charged with a time span rather than a date specific?
Your Honor, I haven't really fully thought that out. I don't think that the way it was charged was incorrect. I think that there was also testimony that based on the quantity of the amount of methamphetamine that was found in the home during the search, that it was not consistent with personal use. I see that I'm out of time. If there are no additional questions.
Before you sit down, I want to ask you a brief question about the handgun that was found in the closet.
Yes, Your Honor.
Where within, and to be clear, that handgun was discovered by one of the officers while they were trying to clear the house. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Where within that closet was the handgun located?
Your Honor, Officer Wackler testified he opened the closet door and there was a shelf that I believe he testified to him it was about eye level, and that there was a shoebox or some sort of box and that the handle of the gun was sticking out of the box. And he testified that he immediately knew that it was the handle of a weapon, that it was the handle of a gun. And so that handle was...
He was looking for people, intruders.
Correct, Your Honor.
Is it reasonable to look for intruders on the top shelf of a bedroom closet?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that it was necessarily that he opened and looked up. I think he testified that it was at about eye level, so that when he opened that door...
The reason for checking the gun was that he was looking for an intruder, and you wouldn't want to leave loaded weapons around in case the intruder could get access to that and use it against you. Isn't that the statement that was given by the police officer?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think, to be clear, he did not, he didn't see the gun because he opened the box or because he moved things around in the closet or on a shelf. It was immediately apparent when he opened the door.
For what it's worth in terms of facts and credibility, his testimony was consistent with plain view.
Correct, Your Honor, that it was immediately apparent that that was the handle of a weapon. If there are no additional questions, we request that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal, so we will go on to the next case of the day. Mr. Penn, were you up? Thank you very much. Thank you for your service.